From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, school money troubles winding up in the laps of state lawmakers.
We will see just how resolved the legislature is trying to help these children who are essentially trapped in these failing schools.
Plus, praise for a social welfare program that's really working, the Earned Income Tax Credit.
The EITC seems to be better at keeping folks in the social fold than the old welfare system ever was.
A 30th anniversary salute to the Motown Museum.
It is a monument. To many people, it's like Mecca.
An iPad serving as restaurant menus. Do we like this?
To walk in and be presented with an iPad when I just left the office and I've been dealing with a computer, that to me alters the restaurant experience.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. But first, the news. Years ago this month, the Motown Museum opened its doors in Detroit thanks to Berry Gordy's sister, Esther Gordy Edwards.
One day she looked out of the window and it looked like the entire British Navy was on the front lawn. And that was the day she called her brother and said, "I think we made history and didn't know it."
I'm Cynthia Canty, saluting Hitsville, USA today on Stateside. But first, 56 school districts and charter schools in Michigan began the school year in the red. A coalition of community leaders in Detroit is asking the state to assume $350 million in school debt. State lawmakers are being asked for $725,000 to cover unpaid debts of the former Buena Vista School District near Saginaw, the district they dissolved 2 years ago. These are just a few of the many signs of money troubles facing school administrators and state lawmakers. Detroit News reporter Chad Livengood is with us again. Hello, Chad.
Hi, thanks for having me in the program, Cindy.
Always good to have you, Chad. Well, we heard from the Community-Based Coalition for the Future of Detroit School Children, talked with them last week on their wish list is, of course, having the state assume that Detroit district debt to the tune of $350 million. And when we talked with co-chair Tanya Allen, she was very, very clear. She said Detroit's the canary in the mine shaft, and there are so many other districts on shaky financial ground. Which districts, Chad, are in the biggest trouble?
Well, the school district in Pontiac has been in trouble for some time now. They are under a state consent agreement. They have a lot of unpaid bills. They're kind of slowly pulling themselves out of it. Detroit Public Schools is obviously the biggest kahuna in the room here. They've got this $350 million in debt service that essentially is just money borrowed to pay the bills over the last 10 years. And it's been rolled up into one big payment, $53 million a year. $1,200 per student comes off the top of their $7,300 student foundation grant from the state. This is an unusual amount of money per student that is going to operating debt service. This is separate from capital. The coalition in Detroit is not asking for state assistance with the district's capital debt, which some of it is approaching $2 billion in buildings that aren't even being occupied anymore, which is a problem in of itself. But they're just asking for the state to assume this debt payment so that the district doesn't have to make that payment right off the top. That debt service gets paid before any other bills, basically, in Detroit because they don't want default. And the other thing that the coalition is asking for is relief from paying the state pension system, which is a $100 million a year bill on a $700 million budget. And that's probably the bigger, harder, tougher ask here in front of the legislature, because if the legislature granted one school an exemption from paying its pension bill, they'd have to grant 500 school districts the same exemption. Everyone would be in line for that. So there is not a sense that this $350 million is dead on arrival. Mm-hmm. It's just that it's a pretty big amount of money. As Al Pashoka, the chairman of the House Appropriations Committee, told me, it makes Detroit's bankruptcy grand bargain of $195 million look like a used car note.
Ouch. Ouch. But Governor Snyder actually kind of made something that when we told Tanya Allen, she was pleasantly surprised. There were some overtures that he is aware and open to solutions to the problem.
Yeah, and he's actually been a little out in front of this. He included in his proposed school aid budget a $75 million line item for distressed schools. It was kind of vague, and because it was vague and there wasn't actually any committed plan for how the money would be spent, the House and Senate Appropriations Committees have chopped it down to 4 million in the House and 8.9 million in the Senate. But it's still open for negotiation in the legislature if the governor comes to them with a specific plan, which we expect that he probably will this month sometime. And that could be to pay that $53 million payment for DPS. It could be to free up some more money for the emergency loan fund for schools, which is nearly tapped out. They created this $50 million loan fund a couple of years ago, and distressed schools in Benton Harbor, Muskegon Heights, Pontiac, the former districts of Inkster and Buena Vista, which got dissolved, they have borrowed money from this fund, and it's nearly out of money. And so the governor's Treasury Department has already asked for the fund to be doubled. So a lot of these things could be all kind of put into one big package of bills related to distressed schools. This has definitely got the attention of lawmakers more than it has in recent memory.
But as the school year is wrapping up, you see administrators who have to plan ahead for the 2015-2016 school year, and then the legislature's going on summer vacation in a couple of months. So what needs to happen and by when to help these struggling districts?
Well, we make the assumption the legislature is going on summer vacation.
True.
The prevailing thought in Lansing is right now, if Proposal 1 goes down in flames on May 5th, which a lot of people are predicting it will, the legislature is going to spend some more time in Lansing working on budget issues, this being one of them, and also the roads. And so this is all going to kind of come to a head here in May. If Proposal 1 passes, there's suddenly going to be $300 million and more revenue for education available, which will probably make this proposal to try to help out DPS or other distressed schools a lot more amenable.
And without state assistance, what's going to happen?
Without state assistance, the coalition and the district will argue that DPS will continue to run up $100 million plus deficits and be unable to sort of get a clean slate as their enrollment kind of continues to decline with the declining population of school-age children. So the problem is not going to go away anytime soon.
And not just DPS, but looking at all of these other ailing districts all over the state.
Yeah, there is 56 school districts that started this school year in deficit. And so several of them are going to come out, they're projecting to come out of deficit by the end of June, but there are still a lot of struggling schools. And these financial struggles do correspond with academic struggles. And so we will see just how resolved the legislature is trying to help these children who are essentially trapped in these failing schools.
Chad Livengood with the Detroit News. Always good to talk with you, Chad. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Technology invades the restaurant dining experience. No, not diners posting photos of their food to Facebook or Instagram. Some restaurants in Michigan are replacing their old-school paper menus with iPads. Our Detroit Magazine's chief wine and restaurant critic, Chris Cook, is here. Chris, have you been presented with an iPad for a menu yet?
I have, actually, yes, twice. I haven't seen too many around Southeast Michigan, but I think it's going to become a growing trend.
And what was it like? What was it for? To make choices? To check out what's available?
Well, it gives you an awful lot more than you do off of a paper menu. That's one thing. I mean, there are photographs of the food. There's all kinds of history of food that they can put on there. They put all the ingredient issues, whether you're allergic to something. All that information is in there. It can be quite extensive depending what the restaurant wants to do. And I think it's something that's here to stay, definitely. I think it's going to work very well for restaurants in terms of how they're going to be able to speed up the service. I mean, the servers are the ones that are going to be doing a lot less, I think, because of these new iPads. They just put the order in, they tap them in, and then everything is in there. It's calculated. There's a billing system that could go on, and some of these things have actually the card swipers on them. They're coming in with those. So that what the server then, his her job is reduced somewhat to becoming more somebody who's delivering stuff to the table.
Not necessarily explaining things the way that we are kind of used to.
They can, but it's also on the iPad. Depending on the restaurant, depending on the server, it could go either way. So a lot can be left up to the customer and that iPad.
So let's talk about this first from the server's perspective. If I'm a server, I might be looking askance at this because what's the tip for? You know, if the iPad's doing most of the work.
this is one of the questions I think that these new iPads raise. Mm-hmm. I don't think they provide answers yet, and we're going to be looking at different variations of answers along the way. But certainly it's going to interrupt a lot of what the server does now.
And what we're used to. Because what's it like for the diner? What do you think the ramifications were for you as the diner being handed this iPad?
I think there's less ramifications for the diner than there is for the server and the restaurant itself. I think it's really a tool that's going to, in a lot of cases, improve things efficiently for the restaurants and the servers. But the diner is just using a tool that they know already. The one thing I do think that's a bit of an issue, it would be for me, but then I'm an old guy, is I like the idea of going to a restaurant, any restaurant, and having an interaction with a server. I appreciate that. I enjoy that. I also enjoy even knowing how much they really know what they're talking about and how much they don't know what they're talking about. It tells me something about the restaurant. And to walk in and be presented with an iPad when I just left the office and I've been dealing with a computer, that to me alters the restaurant experience somewhat. Now, I don't think it will be that much of an alteration necessarily for the younger generation, but maybe it will. I certainly hope it will because I want them to have the same restaurant experience that I enjoy nowadays.
Just circling back to the servers, do you think this ultimately could result in fewer servers if this takes hold and more restaurants bring in these iPads?
I don't see it that way. I think the number of servers remains the same. They're still needed. But what they
because
do
the iPad
is what
cannot bring out your spaghetti.
Well, exactly.
Yeah.
And the iPad can't smile and sing and say, have a nice day either, which in some cases may be a good thing. But yet that's part of the human contact, too, that the iPad can't do.
Where do you think these would work best?
The prominence will be in the lower to middle dining experience. I don't see these going into an expensive restaurant. The expensive restaurant where you're tipping 20%, not only do they have servers that are making decent money and are very professional, and that's what you go for, but you also go for that same kind of experience. Where I see the change possibly coming along is in those middle and lower ones that have these iPads. It's a possibility I can see developing that some of these restaurants are going to say, you know, maybe the tip ought to be smaller. That becomes an issue for servers.
Absolutely does. Interesting. Watch a sign of the times to see if we start picking up more of these iPads as we walk in. Good point about I was on them all day at work. Do I really want to be on one again? Our Detroit Magazine's chief wine and restaurant critic, Chris Cook. Always good to talk with you, Chris.
Thank you for having me.
Still to come, praise for a social welfare program from the government that seems to be working. The Earned Income Tax Credit. That's in 20 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It was spring of 1967 when Marvin Gaye recorded yet another Motown smash hit. One more hit coming out of that little house on West Grand Boulevard in Detroit, the house known as Hitsville, USA. Hitsville, USA was Motown's first headquarters until Berry Gordy moved the label to L.A., but there was a new life ahead for that little house at 2648 West Grand Boulevard. And 30 years ago this month, April 16, 1985, it became the Motown Museum, drawing visitors from all around the world. Writer Jim McFarlane is with us. His profile of the Motown Museum is in the April issue of Our Detroit Magazine. Always good to have you with us and to talk with you, Jim McFarlane.
Cindy, it's always a pleasure to be with you. I'm so happy to be here.
I know. We go back a ways. I've always loved your writing, especially your music writing. And we're very happy to welcome back to Stateside Motown Museum CEO Robin Terry, who is the granddaughter of museum founder Esther Gordy Edwards. Hello again, Robin.
Well, hello. Glad to be back.
Jim, in the history of popular music, of R&B, how important is that building, is Hitsville?
It is a monument. To many people, it's like Mecca. And when I was doing rock and roll for the Detroit News for many years, whenever I would run into a British band, any band from overseas, and they knew I was from Detroit, the first thing they would ask me is about the museum. Have you been to Hitsville? Can we go to Hitsville? How do you get to Hitsville? Well, I remember especially Sheena Easton. I interviewed years and years ago when she was actually popular. And she was I was interviewing her at the Renaissance Center. And she was talking about getting to the Motown Museum. And she said that, like many British artists, she learned to sing, quote unquote, American by listening to Motown music. She would emulate Mary Wells and Diana Ross, and she would try to sing like them to lose her accent. So for a lot of artists, Motown is just like a place you need to, it's a touchstone, a place you need to be and need to see.
And gratefully, it's still there to be seen, right, Robin?
It absolutely, and I would just add to that great story that, you know, we might be able to just credit the British for there being a Motown Museum, because my grandmother would often tell the story of her being there in the offices. Those were just her offices when her brother and family and the Motown Record Corporation moved to Los Angeles. She just convinced her brother that there needed to be a Detroit presence for Motown, and she wanted to maintain that. And at that time, she had been the family historian, the company historian, so she had just collected things. But people would come to Hitsville just wanting to peek into Studio A to see where all of that great Motown music was made. And she said one day she looked out of the window and it looked like the entire British Navy was on the front lawn. And that was the day she called her brother and said, I think we made history and didn't know it. And it was from that point forward that she really committed herself to creating a museum so that people could come from all over the world to see the beginnings of that Motown story.
You know, what I think, Jim, that that second Motown headquarters was that office building
right,
on Woodward. Yeah, just north of the Fox mm-hmm. Theater that yeah. sat derelict for years before it was torn down and that big hole was left. And I wondered, how close do you think we came to having that same fate befall that little house were it not for Esther Gordy Edwards?
Yeah, were it not for her. I don't know. But thank God for her and for the foresight that she had, not only to preserve that house, but that vast collection that today tells the story of what happened in that house.
And as I told Robin when we met for this interview, I had a chance to know her grandmother, an honor for me. And she was such a kind and gentle lady. She was such a lady in every sense of the word. But she was
yes.
she was a family historian. She was a family conscience. She was a family. I mean, it would not be there, I'm convinced, if it had not been for her, because she saw the need to preserve a memory. She saw a need to have a place where people could come, no more so than when the Motown the Musical opened here in Detroit recently and got everybody who had a Motown connection just flocking. They had a place to go. You know,
exactly.
Had the museum not
yes.
been there, where would they have met?
Well, you know, there's that, like when you go to Memphis and you see what should have been the home of Stax, and it's a lot. You know, it's just there's a plaque,
mm-hmm.
and that's all there's there. And then there's the museum they build after, but it's just not the same. It is not the same.
And that's the beauty of it, is that it really is the only place on this planet that you can go to studio, that you can go to and literally stand in the footsteps of those musical icons. It's the only place that you can do that. And so, you know, we're very grateful that that building has continued to be there and continued to serve as a beacon in the community and for the music community, because you're absolutely right. It didn't have to be standing today.
You know, Jim, there have been some very, very big boosts through the years for Hitsville, starting right out of the gate after it became a museum. And Michael Jackson was one of the first to jump in and help, wasn't he?
He was.
Absolutely. Yes, he was. I mean, even today, we have his fedora hat and his jeweled glove that he presented to the museum. That was back in 1988, along with a significant contribution at the time.
And did that kind of jumpstart other contributions, Robin? Did other people come to rally after that?
I think it did. There's always room for more.
Don't hold back.
But it certainly just raised the awareness of the museum, not only among the artist community, but, you know, communities in general. Once Michael Jackson comes to your front door and does something, people take notice.
And, of course, in fact, Robin, you were on Stateside as we talked about Sir Paul McCartney, who
yes.
didn't want to play his show in Detroit at Comerica Park until he had gone over, paid homage, at Hitsville and seen the decrepit piano. And I know we talked to you about how he paid to have it rehabbed, fixed up, did a benefit concert, and shipped it back to you. And, Jim, how significant was it for the Henry Ford to become involved?
Oh, I think it's very important. You know, we have great museums in this city, and the fact that they tend to interact and help each other out, I think is very significant. I think any tourist, any visitor who comes to Detroit, and you should come to Detroit, visitors and tourists, because it's a great city. There are places, it's the DIA, it's the Henry Ford, it's the Motown Museum. You could make a day just seeping yourself in the art and the history of the city. And I think that when there's a cooperative effort, it just helps to raise the level. All the boats rise up because of that.
Robin, when you walk through the doors of Hitsville these days, what do people see?
The first thing is that you're greeted, you know, by some very talented docent who then begins to take you through this incredible journey that is Motown. So you get up close and personal to not only the story of the Gordy family and sort of where that whole entrepreneurial spirit that Berry Gordy had, where that was seated. You learn about his story, and then you venture into the story of these young, talented people who were from Detroit, and most people don't know that, like, most of the Motown artists came from within a 5-mile radius of the Hitsville house. So they came right out of the neighborhoods, right out of the churches, and made their way to this little house on the boulevard where, you know, this new kind of music was being made.
And it was being made around the clock, wasn't it?
It was being made 24 hours a day. So you follow that journey, and then, you know, the icing on the cake is that you literally step back in time to 1959, 1960s in Berry Gordy's apartment and then in the early Motown offices, and everything's been restored to its original condition, and then ultimately make your way into Studio A, which is the highlight. That is the highlight.
If I may just jump on that to echo Robin's earlier point, I took the tour as just a visitor because I wanted to see what the experience was like. And it's so cool because when you get to certain places, they'll go, well, if you stand here, this is where Berry Gordy stood. If you sing here, Smokey Robinson probably sang on that microphone and he played on this piano. So they really put you in the footsteps of the artist as you go through the tour, and you must be prepared to sing because they make you sing. and the funny thing is, no one has to wonder what the lyrics are. No one goes, how's that song going? They say, sing Baby Love. Everybody's right there.
Yes.
They're on point. You know, so
yeah. Star for a day in Studio A because, you know, Motown Museum, like Motown, there's nothing traditional about it. We sing, we dance, we clap. I mean, it's an experience.
I was surprised to see in your piece in Our Detroit, Jim McFarland, more than 75% of the visitors are tourists. So they're coming from elsewhere. Is it just kind of that locals don't think to go?
I think it's the hero in your homeland kind of thing.
Yeah.
I mean, we're proud to have it here. There's a certain swelling of local pride to know that the Motown, we created this sound and here's the museum. But people don't tend to, you know, I hate to tell out of school stories, but one of the tour guides told me that she lived in Detroit and she ran up and down West Grand Boulevard for years until she got the job. She'd never been in the museum. That's not atypical. We know it's there. Mm-hmm. We're proud that it's there. We love that it's there, but we don't go in to actually see it. And that's a shame because it's so much better. I remember it from my rock and roll years back in the 80s. I remember it, and to see it now, it's light years beyond what it was before.
So
it truly is a museum.
If you went back in the early days, it's worth going back and seeing what it's grown into.
Yes, it's not even close to what it was in its early years. It's an experience, and one that if you love music at all, any kind of music, I think you owe it to yourself to express that experience.
Robin, I know you've been a part of the museum since you were a docent when you were in high school, and now you're the CEO. What is your vision for the Motown Museum in the future?
Motown Museum, to me, has to return to what it was and what it represented in the Detroit community when it was at its heyday. And so what does that mean? Do we want to start recording music? No. But it had a magnetic effect in the community for those who were creative and wanted to make music. And I think it's important in terms of our programming that we continue to foster creativity in the Detroit community and abroad, and to continue to be a place where creative people can gather to not only make music, but to just be creative, be innovative. One of the programs that we have, which runs for the entire month of April, is called Motown Mike, and it's a spoken word series. And it's really a tribute to Motown's Black Forum label. And many people don't know that Motown had a spoken word label where greats like Dr. Martin Luther King, Langston Hughes, Stokely Carmichael, Elaine Brown, all recorded on this particular label. So we started a series called Motown Mike. Every Friday night from 8 to 10, poets from the Detroit area come and compete and do their own pieces. And then in June, we have a big finale with the top 10 contestants. Creating more programming like that to give Detroiters a reason to come back to Hitsville and to continue to create and build on that phenomenal legacy that exists there, that's really what the future of the museum has to be about.
And it's worth mentioning, and I bet this kind of came out of the relationship with the Henry Ford because they do this. There's a membership card now.
Yes. Again, it goes back to community. So we're celebrating 30 years. And as we approach the 30 years, we said, you know what? We really need to find creative ways to reconnect, not just with our global fans, but our Detroiters in particular. And so this membership program is just that. It's an opportunity for your average hard-working person, whoever it is, it doesn't matter what your station is in life, but for you to engage with this legacy, engage with this important history, and sort of establish your ownership in it, be a part of it. We started, there's a campaign that you're going to hear about over the next several months as we launch the membership program called I Am Motown. And the idea is that we have people all over this globe who make their way to Hitsville. All of them feel the same kind of ownership. You know, Motown music played some important role in their lives. They claim that they are Motown. I am Motown. And they can say that with great pride. So this campaign is really to encourage people wherever they are to just take that ownership and join us and become a part of the support of this and preservation of this legacy.
Jim, what have you heard from folks that you didn't expect to once your story hit out there? And
I always do. It's always gratifying. You know, I'm honored to work for that publication. Our Detroit has been very good to me over the years. I've survived six editors, I think, over my time there. And it's always nice because, like Robin suggests, you mention the Motown name and people get nostalgic and they want to talk about it and they want to talk about their relationship to it. You know, Barry designed that music. He produced it in such a way that it was meant to be heard in car speakers. He thought about people in that era driving up and down Woodward Avenue listening to his music, and he wanted to make sure it sounded best coming out of those little cheap Ford card speakers. And he did that. And so a lot of people have memories of cruising, the romance, first dates, you know. That music brings back a whole lot of memories because it was in a specific time and place. And whenever you mention the Motown sound and the Motown Museum, people want to call and just wax nostalgic about it.
All right, lightning round, final question. Jim McFarlane, your very favorite Motown song?
Oh, Heard It Through the Grapevine. Either version, but of course Marvin's is best.
Robin?
Probably the anthem, Martha Reeves. Calling out around the world, are you ready for a brand new beat?
Robin Terry is the CEO of the Motown Museum, and you can get lots more information about visiting the Motown Museum and also the 30th anniversary celebrations. Just go to motownmuseum.org. And Jim McFarlane's story, Not the Same Old Song, is in the April issue of Our Detroit magazine. Thanks so much to both of you for joining us on Stateside.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Support for arts and culture coverage on Stateside comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs and the National Endowment for the Arts. Rosa Parks has made it to the Final Four. No, really. The woman who is revered as the godmother of the civil rights movement is among four women who are now finalists in that grassroots campaign to get a woman's face on the $20 bill. Susan Ada Stone is the University of Michigan alum who's now the executive director of Women on 20s. She said this nation's long overdue for a woman's face on one of our bills.
They all bear portraits of men that haven't changed since 1929, and we think that is very last century. 2015, we are a much more diverse and inclusive country, and we think that our money should reflect that.
We spoke with Stone last month on Stateside as that campaign was getting launched. You can find that interview at michiganradio.org. The other finalists include humanitarian and abolitionist Harriet Tubman, former First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt, and Cherokee Nation Chief Wilma Mankiller. You can cast your vote online. Just go to womenon20s.org, and that's the number 20. That's womenon20s.org. The group will present its results to the Department of the Treasury in hopes of convincing the department to start issuing a new $20 bill by 2020 to mark the 100th anniversary of the passage of the 19th Amendment. Still to come, spring weather is heating up in Michigan, and the emergency alert system is keeping up with the times, bringing notifications right to your smartphone. We'll hear more in 10 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Road repair is not the only thing at stake when we head to the polls next month to decide the fate of Proposal 1. The Earned Income Tax Credit is part of that proposal. The program is designed to help the working poor. In Michigan, it was scaled back by Governor Snyder and the Republican legislature in 2011. But state lawmakers have approved boosting the EITC in Michigan if voters approve the road funding ballot proposal that would raise the sales tax from 6% to 7%. Well, that means nearly 800,000 low to moderate income families in Michigan could see this targeted tax relief expanded. A Michigan State University researcher has been exploring just what the EITC means to families all across the country. Jennifer Sykes is an assistant professor of social relations and policy at MSU's James Madison College. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
The title of the paper that you published in the American Sociological Review is Dignity and Dreams, What the EITC Means to Low-Income Families. How effective is this social policy?
This is a wonderful social policy in terms of its proven effectiveness in reducing poverty nationally. So there is a national earned income tax credit, which is the subject of my study, and then there is the state EITCs. About half of states have their own earned income tax credits. And we know that it works. It's a modest sum at the state level. The federal earned income tax credit is more substantial, but we know that it lifts millions out of poverty. In the last year, about 6 million people, over half of them children, were lifted out of poverty.
And we know it all came out of President Clinton's anti-poverty policy. And as you quote him in your paper, if you work, you should not be poor. And that was in 1993. So you're right. There's been enough time to really get the impact. Recap for us just how the EITC works.
Sure. So, in fact, the Earned Income Tax Credit was passed in the 70s. But you're right to point out that Clinton was the one to greatly expand the credit. And the nature of the social safety net in the last 20 years has fundamentally changed pretty powerfully. The U.S. government has sharply curtailed the cash welfare, and now it expands benefits to those who are working. So this program, the Earned Income Tax Credit, comes to folks when they file their taxes. And those who have dependent children qualify, those who work qualify, and depending on whether you're married or single, you get different amounts for the credit.
Can you give us just a ballpark idea? Let's say a family of four, what might they typically get in their refund?
Okay, well, let me give you some sense of how big it can be.
Yes.
So the maximum credit for the 2014 tax year, if you're a single mom with three qualifying children, you could get as much as about $6,000. Now, the average credit is actually less than half of that, but that's the maximum. And it's really a program that's designed for working parents who have children. If you're a working individual who doesn't claim dependents on your taxes, you can get some, but it's about $500, and it's quite modest in comparison to the amount that you would get if you have children. This is an anti-poverty program that is really meant to help working families with children.
And you and your three colleagues interviewed 115 low-income recipients. What were you trying to learn, and what questions were you trying to answer?
So we were wondering, as one of the largest means-tested government programs, how people spent their earned income tax credit. Also, how they perceived it, how they thought about this money, how they planned to spend it, and then how they actually spent it.
And I got the sense from reading your paper that you really found that the EITC gives these families a very valuable sense of being included and being invited to the party that it seems the rest of the nation is in on.
Yes. We find that welfare dollars are very different than this kind of money. It's targeted at folks who are working. And what we find is, you're exactly right to say that this is money that is special. We find a couple of different central features of the program that cultivate what we call social inclusion. The first is that these folks who get this credit are workers, so they're not dependents. These are families that emphasize that they're playing by the rules. And as you said, Clinton promised, if you work, you should not be poor. So they would emphasize that. But secondly, another feature that seems important in our research is that the method of delivery by which we give folks this money is pretty different. Instead of going to what used to be maybe a degrading welfare office and asking for money, these recipients of this credit go to a for-profit tax preparer like an H&R Block. And so the method is different in terms of the delivery. They also get this money not delivered over the course of 12 months, but it comes as part of their refund check. So the process is very similar to every other American. Everyone has to file their taxes, and they're getting it not as a stigmatized check, but as kind of a one-time lump sum benefit. And this big amount, we argue and we find, allows a temporary, though modest, elevation in the consumption that they're able to engage in.
Now, what are they doing with their tax credits when they get the refund? What are they doing with that money?
The first thing that we would know is that it's relief from debt. So not surprisingly, most of these families are, as I said earlier, they're working poor or working near poor. So a quarter of it off the bat is spent paying on debts and bills. About another quarter is spent on current bills. So they might pay ahead on their car insurance or pay a lump sum in their car insurance. About one-fifth is spent on mobility or asset purchases, things like cars, educational expenses for themselves or their children. A much more modest amount, 17%, is spent on savings. And then we have folks who are spending on treats as well. This features prominently in the article you probably read, but it's not a great deal of money, possibly. It's 1 in 10 of refund dollars, but we find that it's symbolically very significant.
I have to imagine for a mother or a father to be able to give their kids maybe those shoes that the youngster has really been pining for, that's powerful for both the parent and the child.
Oh, you're right. They're using a portion of the refund to splurge on their kids in really modest ways. So they're taking them to a sit-down restaurant a couple of times after they get their refund. They might buy a special item of clothing or a cartoon character bedspread or a special toy. I remember one mother, I think her name was Claire, she told me, sometimes my kids get what they need, but it's not what they want. So with this money, meaning the refund money, yeah, I was able to take them to Target and let them pick out clothes. And it might have been a couple dollars more expensive, but it made them feel like $1 million. So I think you're right to say that it reinforces their positive parenting identities. They're indulging in a way that probably middle-class parents are able to year-long. And this is a special kind of bright spot in their financial lives.
What do you think the message is of your study to policymakers, both state and federal, Jennifer?
I would underline that this is an extraordinarily effective social policy. When it comes to having to assist folks, the working poor who are struggling with their declining minimum wage wages, we have to come up with a way to assist them. We just have to. This earned income tax credit seems a good vehicle for that. It rewards those who are working. It does so in a way that allows them to save some money. And so I would say that the punchline of our study is that while we might not go far enough in our poverty alleviation efforts, the EITC seems to be better at keeping folks in the social fold than the old welfare system ever was.
The title of the paper in the American Sociological Review is Dignity and Dreams, What the EITC Means to Low-Income Families, co-written by my guest, Jennifer Sykes, Assistant Professor of Social Relations and Policy at James Madison College at Michigan State University. Jennifer, it was great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
One of the realities of spring in Michigan is dicey weather. Well, now there's a new way for authorities to let us know if severe weather threatens. It's on your smartphone, the WEA, Wireless Emergency Alerts. Cliff Lampe is back here with us now. He's an associate professor at the U of M School of Information. Hello, Cliff.
Hi, how are you?
Good. And Rich Pullman's with us. He's a warning coordination meteorologist with NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Rich, it seems NOAA and the National Weather Service really have challenges as to when to warn people of possible severe weather, what that actually means, what kind of weather, and then how to get that warning out there in the fastest, most effective way possible. Did I miss anything?
No, I don't think you did. It is a challenge. We're all so mobile, and technology is changing, and our ability to detect storms has changed over the course of the past two decades. So trying to get that information out to the public and to give them the information that they need to act appropriately has always been a challenge. And I think technology is helping us now that we're in 2015 and beyond, but we still need ways to reach everybody to get them that warning information.
And, you know, I just think of this dilemma that you face, knowing when to warn and when not to has to be key, because people are going to tune you out if they think that these weather folks are crying wolf again. And God help you if severe weather hits an area, people suffer any kind of loss and feel they didn't get that advance warning. Cliff, how do the wireless emergency alerts help with this?
Well, increasingly, people are not watching mass media channels. So they're either watching television that's time delayed, or they're watching Netflix or Amazon Prime. So they're not watching live broadcasts as much. They're not, unfortunately, listening to radio as much as they might have in the past. So how do you actually get a hold of people? Most people actually have a cell phone attached to them. And so there's actually a big program that WEA is part of that allows federal government to push certain types of emergency alerts through the cell phone company to your individual cell phones.
And what would these alerts be?
There's three types. One are presidential alerts. Another are imminent disasters or threats. And the third are amber alerts.
And these are not anything we sign up for, right? These just come across on our smartphones.
They just come across on your smartphones. Cell phone providers have voluntarily signed up for this service. It's a partnership with them, Homeland Security, and a few other federal agencies. Not every provider provides this service, and not every phone provides this service.
All right, so it's more the if you've got the smartphone, but if you've got one of the older ones, you're not going to necessarily get that.
Potentially not, right.
Ultimately, I think as people upgrade to this, we'll pretty much all have that.
That's correct.
Rich, how does this work for meteorology? Like, what kind of weather events would trigger one of these WEAs?
Well, it's going to be for the imminent danger warnings. So in southeast Michigan, we're going to be mainly looking at the tornado warning and the flash flood warning. As we modernize our warning information and get more information into the digital stream, we'll probably be able to, in the future, warn for those most significant severe thunderstorms that might be producing winds of 80 miles an hour and or hail that's 2 inches in diameter or larger. A generic severe thunderstorm, if you want to call it generic, is going to have hail up to an inch and severe thunderstorm winds of about 60 miles an hour. So those most dangerous ones in the future could happen. What's great about the WEA is that it's based on where you are and whether you get alerted or not. So if you happen to be traveling in Florida and a hurricane warning is issued, it does trigger for that. If you're in California and there's a tsunami warning, it will alert for that. And if you're in Phoenix with a dust storm warning, it will trigger for those warnings as well. So those are the basic weather warnings. For the tornado warning for southeast Michigan, we issue the warnings not on a county-by-county basis, but we actually issue the warnings based on the storm's location and where that storm's projected path is located. So we might just be issuing for the south half of a particular county. The WEA will send that broadcast message based on where the cell tower is in that box that we draw for the warning. So if you happen to be in the north part of the county, you will not be alerted for that alert because you are not in the tornado warning.
So it's very targeted, and it prevents unnecessary alerts that are going to make people just go, oh, it's that again, and tune it out.
Yeah, specifically for the weather warnings. Yeah, if you get that alert, you know you're in the warning. And it's great because that warning area that you're worried about is just your own personal space. Whether you're driving in the car down I-75, you will get the alert if you are in that warning box. And if you're not, you won't get the alert on your phone.
Cliff, how quickly can all this happen?
Very quickly. As soon as a recognized government agency alerts the telephone companies, they can get the message out to their cell phone towers.
All right. Now, I recall hearing an odd tone going off on my iPhone somewhere around 5 in the morning just late last month. And I was awake enough to wonder, what is that? But not awake enough to want to look at it and see what it was. And it turns out it was an Amber Alert for a child from Flint. And happily, she turned up safe and sound later that day. But what I noted is on Facebook, there was a surprising amount of grumbling. And I'm wondering, Cliff, is this because this thing, in this case the Amber Alert, kind of forced its way onto people's smartphones unbidden and unasked for? Do you think that got hackles up?
That's a lot of the concern about this program, is that when you have Amber Alerts and they go off at an inconvenient time in the morning, it's going to cause people to seek out ways to block these kinds of alerts and then prevent them from getting shelter-in-place messages or other important types of things. Yeah. So it's a balancing act that the government agencies have to maintain for when and how they alert people. The Amber Alerts are a little bit tougher than the weather alerts in some ways because you don't know necessarily which geographic area to target as specifically as NOAA does for a weather event.
And people can opt out.
You can. The telephone companies don't like to advertise it, but there is a way to go in and opt out, yes.
Except for the presidential warnings.
except for the presidential yeah. warnings that you cannot opt out of.
And it is going to depend on your provider and your phone on how much you can opt out, what your settings you have available. I mean, some of them, it's kind of an all or nothing except for the presidential. But you do have some programmability, if you will, with your phone.
What do you think could be next down the road in getting emergency information to the public very quickly and very efficiently?
I think this will be in place for quite a while. I don't think there's a technology that's going to replace this anytime soon. I mean, you could imagine a future with smartwatches or other things like that. But I do think that pushing towards mobile devices makes a lot of sense, both for what Ursula was saying about, you know, it's targeted to the area where you happen to be at the time, but also because of the geographic precision that the cell phone tower arrangement really allows you. So I think this has got some staying power as a tool.
And Rich, just looking ahead for tornado season, what's the span? When does it start and how long does it last?
Well, here in Michigan, our tornado season's pretty much May, June, and July is the peak. Although you can expect the threat of tornadoes, if we get the right atmospheric conditions, to go anywhere from April 1st into the fall. And as far as a forecast into the severe weather season, it's hard to make a forecast on a severe thunderstorm that may only be 5 to 25 miles in diameter. And it really only takes one event at your location for it to be a bad severe weather season. So we try to stay out of the prediction business for a climate forecast for the severe weather season for the summer. It could be very quiet and just have one tornado outbreak, and that's going to make for a bad year, even though our statistics say it was a below-average year.
Good point. NOAA meteorologist Rich Pullman and University of Michigan Information Professor Cliff Lampe, and thank you for enlightening us when we hear that unusual chime of the phone. Don't ignore it. Check it out. And for heaven's sakes, no getting on Facebook crabbing because there was an Amber Alert. I think we could all be a little better than that. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The newest, oldest person on Earth is a Michigander. Geraldine Talley of Inkster turns 116 next month, and she became the world's oldest person this week following Monday's death of a 116-year-old Arkansas woman named Gertrude Weaver. We should note Gertrude Weaver only held her spot for 5 days. She became the oldest person just last Wednesday after a 117-year-old Japanese woman passed away. Back to Geraldine Telly, born in Georgia in 1899. She moved to Michigan in 1935, and she lived on her own until just 7 years ago when she was 108. And we offer our congratulations to Geraldine Telly, the oldest person on Earth. Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer is Peg Watson. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.